Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Get everything for your next project today at Menards and save big money. Keep your walls and trim protected while you paint with Scotch Blue Painter's Tape. It's designed for use on multiple surfaces and can be removed easily without leaving residue behind. Save big on Scotch Blue Painter's Tape from Menards. Also, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and check out all of our great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Get everything for your next project today at Menards and save big money. Keep your walls and trim protected while you paint with Scotch Blue Painter's Tape. It's designed for use on multiple surfaces and can be removed easily without leaving residue behind. Save big on Scotch Blue Painter's Tape from Menards. Also, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and check out all of our great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Than whole, riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking, yeah. Can none of y'all mirror me back? Yeah, hear me rap, it's like hand G rapping his prime. I'm young H.O., rap's grateful dead. Back to take over the globe, now break bread.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Miami Nice. I'm one half of your undercover partnership, Blake Howard. With me, as always, rocking our 2005 Miami Vice crew hat, and also back from a bonanza of a 40th birthday is one Katie Walsh.
Yes, I'm like here but not here. I'm very much still in Sunny Crockett mode. I went and got lost in the islands.
Did you get full dirt bag? Please tell us later in the show. Thank you so much for being here. But like February 16, 2018, so nearly like almost around the same time that Katie and I not only met, but then did the special Den of Thieves bonus episode of One Heat Minute that forged our friendship. I spoke to another Miami Vice obsessive, and it was actually part of the reason why I sought him out to be part of One Heat Minute, because I kept seeing Fire Michael Mann tweets, Miami Vice knowledge. And because he's been busy writing comic books, writing television shows, and doing all of those things, it took us a long time to come back together. But this is the kind of guy who knows the Vincent Hanekin wield an FNC NATO assault rifle better than a chicken drumstick. It is the awesome Brian Hill. Brian, thank you so much for coming back and being a part of Miami Nice when you rediscovered that we had gone down right into your wheelhouse of Michael Mann obsession. You were like, how haven't I been on this show, Blake? What is going on? And I'm here to say the welcome mat was always rolled out for you. Like, it was just a matter of time, and now you're here.
Well, see, I had to be worthy, you see, because this appearance is the peak of my Hollywood career. Right? It will be downhill here. I know that. So you just, you know, it's sometimes you just got to stand by the window and look at the coastline and wait for the rack focus to bring you back into the scene.
Yeah,
Well, we had to, you know, get our skills up to par too. We had to build our repertoire so we would be worthy of you.
We knew this was going to be the fire one. It was going to get really, really heated. So, man, thank you so much for coming back. I know folks who had listened to One Heat Minute loved our episode. I got lots of great feedback then at the time. And then as people progressively go along, people talk about episodes they really loved. If you're not familiar, the 114th minute of Michael Mann's Heat is in fact the moment that Vince and Hannah like goes into that deep, deep focus and takes out Michael Chirita, Tom Sizemore's character. And so it's an epic moment. It's at the crescendo. It's after already, you know, kind of 6 minutes of utter chaos. And we got to talk about everything at the time, but you are like the ultimate Miami Vice rather 2006 fan. You've been like ride or die all the time. People can go to your Twitter profile right now and you've got the banner of the boys in the car together. So let's just get started because, you know, I know there's a sort of big thesis of everything that we wanted to talk about, but can you tell the people about why you love this movie?
Yeah. So Miami Vice, the 2006 film, was a formative experience for me creatively. And I watched it, you know, I saw it theatrically and I loved it from the beginning. I wasn't one of those people that like saw it and then like warmed up to it after the think pieces and the Little White Lies of it all and the rest of it. Like I saw it and I fell in love with it. And I think it was because I've always been dichotomous with my creative imagination. You know, part of me has always been a high concept genre person, you know, kind of raised on that stuff, like a VHS video blockbuster kid, that kind of thing. But then the other part of me has always been interested in Italian neorealism, you know, in French New Wave, right? And so when I saw Miami Vice, I saw that as the intersection of both of those things working at peak principle.
Yes.
You know, and I didn't even know that was possible because I thought I had to be bifurcating in terms of how I told stories.
I'm a genre guy or I'm an ethereal philosophical guy. I can never the twain shall meet.
Right. And so, and this was years ago when I was still kind of gathering my voice, but you know that time in your life when you're trying to figure out what your lane is going to be. You know you have to have a lane, right? You know you have to specialize at some point. And then I saw that movie and I was like, oh no, I need to specialize in this, right? I need to specialize in the hybridity of these things. Because it kind of unlocked, like sometimes you experience literature or a piece of music or a film play and it opens up doors. You know, it's sort of like it wraps you up in a chrysalis.
Yes.
While you're experiencing it. And then when it's over, you know, you pop out and you're a butterfly.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how I felt walking out of that theater on Astor Place in New York. That's where I was at the time. Right. And from then on out, I lived in a state of dissonance with the world because no one else seemed to understand what I understood. Right. Like, like when you watch something, you're like, well, clearly that's brilliant. And then you want to get together and talk to your friends about how brilliant it was. And you're like, no, that sucked. And you're like, you're all wrong. Oh no, I have to re-examine all of my creative relationships because everybody is wrong, right?
No, see, I like that reaction where you're like, no, I'm right and you're wrong. Yeah, that, sometimes I'm like, am I being gaslit? Like it's nice to, it's nice to be like, no, I'm standing strong in my assertion of how good this is.
Yeah,
that's a great place to be, even though you're alone on the island. It's a great
absolutely
place to
be. Katie, like, you know, like it's when you have that connection with something and it just clicks and it just makes real sense to you, you know? And when I hear people talk about how, well, you know, I like the movie a lot, but the problem I had was, you know, I grew up on the show and the show was a certain way. And then I saw the movie and the movie wasn't that way. I'm like, what show are you watching? Because the series is all about Pyrrhic victories.
Yeah.
Right. The series is about futility.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the progressive decline of hope. It's about the gray area becoming black. Like, you know, maybe people got blinded by pastels and sonically blinded by Phil Collins or something, but like the show is dour a lot. And yeah, there are spikes of humor, but, you know, even as a little kid, when I couldn't understand anything that was happening, you know, I understood it emotionally, that this was different. Yeah. The end of this didn't feel like the end of other things I watched, right? It left you with 85% of what you wanted, but there was always that missing 15% unresolved. And we're not in serialized television. So the next week, they didn't like pick it up. Like, that was it.
Yeah.
Like, the thing with Sheena Easton didn't work.
Yeah.
That's it. Next episode, you know?
right.
Right. And so that was my experience of the show. So when I saw the movie, I was like, this is exactly what I thought I was going to get when I saw the original trailer, you know, because I was vibing even on the trailer. I remember, we're about to go into how wild I am. I remember when the website was up, because I was hyped.
Oh,
yes.
I was hyped, you know, because Heat, you know, changed everything about it. Like, I saw Heat and then I was like, okay, I'm different now and whatever. Everyone has to deal with how different I am now. I remember when the website came up, and there was that, because, you know, RZA originally
RZA tune. Usually now people are starting to hear it subliminally in our episodes, because I just start rocking it out there. Like, when we're vibing, I just start like fading in the RZA website theme, because it's rare.
I would rock it. Like, okay, this is how wild I was. I would put it on and just let it play while I was like writing, right? So I'd be writing and it'd just be like, dum, 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 dum. I'm like, this is it, right? And then when I couldn't, I saw the movie, you know, Michael Mann soundtracks are always weird. Like, you know, like,
they this one's especially weird.
Yeah, like, they don't happen on time. And then when they do happen, it's like only on like a 78 somewhere, and you got to get a special record player to play it. And then the songs that are on the soundtrack, they're not the ones that are in the movie. And then you got to go to the other place to get the edit. It's wild.
You're like, I need the RZA.
Well, it's like a Manhunter, right? Like, the version of Heartbeat that plays at the end of Manhunter is not the version that is, one, on the Manhunter soundtrack, two, on the Red 7 release. It's got like extra bass chords, and it's slightly faster. And it's so, you know, you're always like chasing it. So the unicorn of it, because I couldn't find the RZA music, I opened up GarageBand and I just recreated it.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, you recreated it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I just, I'll email it to you. Like, I literally, like, recreated it in GarageBand. I listened to it because I play piano and I produce music.
Oh, okay.
So I listened to it and I was like, well, I gotta rock this out so I can have this loop, you know? And
I'm like, I thought you were just, like, streaming it from the website.
That's what I thought. I'm like, oh, my God, he recreated it.
No.
That's amazing.
No, I went in there and just reproduced it.
Can I just say, before we get back to that, I want to shout out someone on Twitter. I don't know who it is. I think her name might be Al. And her Twitter handle is @employedgf. And she put a video up, which has now had like 6,000 views or 20,000 impressions. And it's just a snippet of 20 seconds and from Miami Vice. And it says, me and the crew looking for the guy who said that Michael Mann didn't have the balls to fade from Jay-Z's Linkin Park banger Numb Encore into a club remix of Nina Simone's Cinnamon. And I watched that clip like 13 times yesterday.
And did you retweet it?
Yes, I did.
Okay, I haven't seen it yet.
I'm going to literally right now live, I'm going to tag you both so you can watch it, because I'm just like, it's so... exactly the kind of brand of all the three people that are on this call. It is it's like,
please do. I mean,
so funny, but you're so right. It's like, there's this wonderful incongruity in his soundtracks where you're like, what is going on? And even Jason Fitzroy Jeffers is a great filmmaker from the Miami area, Caribbean area, said, I never thought I would see such a banger sex scene scored to Indy Ari in a Michael Mann movie. And that was like very recent. And I was like, actually, yeah, that's such a fire music choice, such a weird thing. But, you know, bless his heart. We love it.
Banger sex scene with improv.
Like, yes.
Who is improvising sex? I mean, come on. You talk about elevated experience. Right? Like, we are in the land of elevated experience, right? Like, it's you know, I saw that movie like four times that week, and I was broke. I could not afford to do it. I like didn't eat a day so I could get tickets to Miami Vice.
Amazing.
Because I'm like, wait a minute, did that movie even have a first act? I don't
remember. No, it doesn't.
Did he like shoot it and then just like, oh, I'm gonna cut out the first act because I, you know, we don't really need it. We're just gonna move in there. You know, I met with Chuck Adamson way back in the day, and he just said, listen, like, you know, just forget the first 40 pages of whatever you read. You don't need it. I was like, maybe that's what he did. I don't know. Maybe that's what I needed. I was like taking my screenplays and like chopping off the first 20 pages, and like it's gonna start there.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe Rez.
At the club scene, yeah.
it's just an amazing thing. So yeah, so that's what really started it was that, you know, and it helped me watch things differently, study things differently. So now I didn't feel like, well, on this side I'm watching, you know, my action thrillers, my sci-fi stuff, because I knew that would be my bread and butter. That's how I make my living. I pay my rent because I write action movies and sci-fi movies and, you know, television and comic books, right? And I was like, but I also like this stuff. Like I also have a real room in my heart for Breathless, a real room in my heart for all of this. But I was like, I don't know what that is. Like that's New York independent cinema. I don't know how those things get financed. You know, I kind of know what Hollywood is all about. I don't know what that. But then I was like, oh, okay, I can work this stuff in. Like, and then directorially, which is a deep ambition for me, and cross my fingers, I'll be getting behind the camera on an action thriller this year.
Yes.
You know, and hopefully it'll be one of those movies, Katie, that you watch and you're like, it didn't really come together totally, but this guy has something. Like, I heard you say that before, and I was like, and that's what I want. That's the only review that I'll care about is, does Katie think it didn't really come together, but the guy has something? I'm like, then that's a win, right? And so directorially, it opened things up for me as well, because it does things with camera that you're just not supposed to do. You know, the way compositionally it focuses on things and doesn't focus on other things, it kept me out of like a stock way to approach visualizing a scene, you know, and applying like almost like a near, not documentary, because everything is definitely incredibly constructed. But the idea that you could be precise in your blocking, precise in your production design, precise in your direction of actors, but still allow the camera to emotionally, subjectively kind of go where it wants to go, right? Like little things like...
As soon as you say that, I think of the glare from Fox's Tubbs after Neptune's guys as they leave the club. And he's like, hero shot. He's in the frame, even though the camera's doing a technique that Pete Berg has since ripped off in every movie that he's made since the time of Miami Vice, which is this kind of like floating frame, kind of imperceptible movement. And he's there, the club's bouncing, and then a phone call happens, and then you're like in the tight, sinewy shoulders of Colin Farrell's Sonny as he like bursts out the door and goes onto the roof to like Katie's favorite shot in the movie of him against the purple sky. Like then he's the hero of the movie. Like you're like, wait, did a baton just get passed? Like, I don't know what just happened. Like they become equals on that. It's just so wonderful.
Oh yeah. And that's in like that first reel of a thing where it reminds me of the time I took a homie of mine to go see the Lawrence Fishburne Othello. And I'll explain why I'm bringing this up, because I'm a big Shakespeare fan. I love Shakespeare. I think everything you need to learn about writing fiction, you can learn from studying any Shakespeare, right? Just like, you know, pick one, read it ad nauseum, see it performed, and you'll learn everything you need to learn about how to write, you know, dramatic works. But I remember taking a friend to it, and I could see that it, like, the language was really bothering him. And I leaned over and I told him, don't worry about it. Just keep watching it and your brain will figure it out. And about 20 minutes in, he was like, yo, bro, I get it. My advice is the same way. They are speaking in testosterone haiku, right? Like, you are not going to immediately understand what is happening, you know?
Right.
And it's the kind of dialogue interactions that you get on like an atavistic level, you know, just like, this time will come. Like, what? What does that even mean? And how do you know? You may never see this guy. He might have gotten away with it, bro. But like, you under like, it's like, it, okay, you know, and like, you know, like a 11:47 o'clock and all the rest of it, right? You know, and so like it kind of washes over you. And you're like, I don't really. Oh, wait a minute. Now I'm starting to get it. Now I'm starting to understand what it is. Right.
It's not a. Yeah, it's about the energy. It's about the vibes, which we keep talking about. But it's like, yeah, and they're using so much jargon and like acronyms and stuff, and like they're shooting off all these names about these gangs and stuff right away.
Massive Bull Riders, Pecker Woods. I was like, what? Bad guys.
I know.
Right? He's talking about
Harry
bad
Brotherhood.
Guys.
I think that whole you just lean to your friend and you whisper like, I think that whole chunk was bad guys. I think that that's what they were talking about.
Well, and it's great because you can tell like who was there for the whole show and who came in to do their days, because the people that came in to do their days look pretty confused.
Yeah.
Right? Are you talking about Kieran Hines? No,
he has no idea what's happening. He doesn't know why his hair looks like that. He doesn't know why he has a Japanese last name. He is just in this movie. Like trying to keep up with it.
You know what?
Staring at Colin, like trying to figure this out.
By scene three, when he's like, when you got to, you know, your work makes you lie with dogs. By then, you're like, Kieran Hines, you're a fucking gangster, because you like came in and the first eight scenes you shot, you had no idea what this was. And you're like, you know what? Now I'm going to get, going to start feeling myself.
Oh, because Blake, it's meta.
Yeah.
See, the script is a meta commentary on the movie itself. Like, yeah. And I know, like, I'm going way out here. But like, when he's like, yo, I get it. Undercover, you know, undercover guys, you know, you gotta lie with dogs, right? He's really saying, oh, I get why this makes no sense. Because in a Michael Mann movie, you just got to go with it. Right? Like, that's what he's really saying. He's like, yeah, I get it. This is a Michael Mann movie, and I'm delivering exposition, and it's not going to make sense, and I'm going to walk away into the clouds or something when the scene is over, right? And it taught me, continues to teach me, like, listen, you don't have to cross every T and dot every I.
Yes.
It's okay if a messy take gets in, if it gets there. Like, another example. Clearly, John Hawks is improv-ing on that highway.
Oh, hard. Right?
You can tell from the pacing, like, I gotta go, I gotta go, right? Like, he's like in the moment. Fox, being a natural comedian, is locking in with him. Colin has no idea what's happening.
But it's great because that means that Tubbs and Alonzo are like
they're connected.
They're right there.
And Crockett is not getting it.
And he's not getting it, right? Yeah. I mean, Wenda's going through that mullet and he just doesn't know what's happening. And you know, and then it's like, you don't got to go home, man. You know, and like all that, like it's all there. It reminded me of the moment in Heat, one of my favorite moments of actors having no idea what's happening, is when Hannah and his crew are on the rooftop and they're looking at Macaulay and everybody coming out of the restaurant.
Yeah.
And it's pretty clear that when Pacino is delivering,
it's like a convention.
Right. Like with like the super pregnant Paul, whatever the score, these guys, you know, and all that, right?
Yeah.
If you look at everybody, especially Ted Levine, they don't know what this moment is.
No.
Right? Amazing.
Like they may have read it on the page, but like it's clear. They're just like nodding and like, I guess he's going to call cut when Al is done. Right. And then Al walks off and they're all kind of standing there still a little confused. And then it ends and you're just like, oh, you could keep that take in there. You know, it totally works. It totally makes sense.
For everyone who wants to know, one of my favorite parts of actually speaking to Michael Mann about Heat was telling me the Pacino Wild Ones. And I've literally, this is in my vernacular. Pacino does six takes and gives Michael Mann six fire options of exactly how he has interpreted Michael wants him to do it. And he looks to Michael and's like, we good? And Michael goes, yep, I got everything I need and I got choices. And he's like, got time for a couple wild ones? And Michael's like, let's go, baby. And then the rest of the guys have no fucking idea what he's going to do. He just does it.
No
and
idea.
I'm like, what a fucking gangster relationship those two had, because
but that's how you, yeah, go ahead.
Because they just, I gave such an expert actor. I'm giving you all the choices you need, putting some color on some stuff. I think I feel the tone of where we're at in the story. So I'm going to dial in on that. but then I'm going to see if I can break the artifice of this scene just with something. And then he used the wild ones. And you know what?
That's how you end up with great ass.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can hear Hank Azaria go, Jesus Christ. And it's like, it works for the character who's like, what the hell is this guy doing? But it also works for Hank Azaria being like, what the fuck is going on?
I mean, look at Ashley Judd in the motel room. She is terrified.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like she is terrified of De Niro in that scene. Yeah. You can just tell. Like, that is not a performance. You know, that is like, oh my God, he's going to beat the hell out of me in this scene. Cut. What? Was it good? Cool. Like, if I could sit down with Ashley Dunn, that'd be the first conversation. I'd be like, how scared were you in that motel room? You know, just to understand. Because it there's a realness to it, right? It's what, and if you look at Mann's all of his filmography, what I love about it is it's all barely controlled chaos.
Yes.
You know? And the amount of like courage that it takes to do that on a large scale, like you'll get that in independent films, right? Like Sean Baker is a filmmaker I really love, right? And so you get the controlled chaos of a Sean Baker film, but you're also working at a much smaller budget. You know, you're also working in a way where it's like, well, it's okay, we can kind of do this. To have that approach when you're spending a gargantuan amount of money, right? But to still like live in that space, that takes a certain kind of thing. Like everyone doesn't have the ability to do that without like kind of falling into terror, really, you know? And that's why I think it's kind of remarkable. And also, I look
Brian,
at
can
Miami
we pause there for a second? Because I think you just nailed something, which got me is that in huge productions, and Katie is probably more aware of this as like an educator too, and consuming so many films and helping friends who've made films with notes and things like that, you are trying to limit always based on your budget the interventions or those organic things that are going to break with the budget of the schedule of that day. You're like trying to stop the unknown things, like that's all about these mitigating actions that you do to create it. And what we've heard, both of us, in people that who've worked with Michael Mann and like doing this, even this show, he like has the film, has what he wants, and then every freaking location or every scenario, it's like, let's throw some heat on this. Let's go to Haiti to shoot this scene. Like, it's mostly indoors, but no, I'll get, we're going to Haiti so we can go outside and have this like weird thing. Let's go to Ciudad del Este where like, there's no way I'm going to have permits to just stop the tri-border currency of this like strange part of the world. And even there's some great docos in Black Hat where he's like, you just bombing around Jakarta and he goes, I want to shoot there. And then in Jakarta, they go like, it was like under a bridge where there was like a little market and stuff. And like homeless people had been there and living there and things like that and little things. And then the government, the council went and painted this spot because there was going to be a Hollywood film there. And he went, no, you can't paint it. I want it because it looked trashy and had graffiti. And so then he had his set designers do it. It's like, he seems to have these like things where it's like, how do I, to have him operating at his elevated experience, it can't just be this static space. It has to have life, has to have energy. And it's like these little things that he does all the time. And it's, to be operating at that level is like nuts.
I think part of why he's able to do that creatively, and I never met Mann personally, and I kind of don't want to, because he's perfect right now, and I just don't want to know. Like, I don't want to see him blow his nose, you know. I just want to kind of experience the thing. But I think part of it comes from that deep knowledge of what you're trying to attempt creatively, because you iterate, and he's this king of iteration, right? Like, you know, Miami Vice is one part Smuggler's Blues, one part Robbery Homicide Division, episode 9, I think, right? Yeah. It's basically the same plot. You know, it's Sizemore going undercover, falls in love with an Asian woman who's tied into the thing and the rest of it, right? And it's all very much in there, you know? And you know, we all know that Edie was supposed to be an Asian woman at the beginning of the thing, and then it became Amy Brenneman, right? And, you know, and obviously everybody knows about L.A. Takedown and the rest of it, or how he too is man revisiting Manhunter in a really interesting way that I did not expect him to revisit, you know. And so this constant revisitation of whatever the inner story is, I think opens up new possibilities. And I like to think that, and this might even be subconscious on this part, and this would be the one question I wanted to ask him because I'd love to get his response to it. I think people think that his movies are about crime, like, you know, crime thrillers, character-driven crime thrillers about, you know, that whole thing, the same side, cops and robbers were all the same, right? Sure. But I think on a subconscious level, they're really about the difficulty of being an artist.
Yes.
Yeah.
The difficulty about maintaining your individuality and your independence, maintain that vision and the price you pay for it, and how the victories you get on that path may not be long sustained, but they will be worthwhile, right? And so it's almost a trade-off, you know, like the, it was like the old Blade Runner thing, right? Twice as bright, half as long, you know?
Yeah.
And it's the pursuit of those intensely authentic experiences that are elevated, that you know you cannot sustain, and you know you may pay a price for them, but the price is worth it. And so when I say Miami Vice is anti-genre, it's a brilliantly executed crime thriller that doesn't want to be a crime thriller.
Yeah. It's like, you know, constantly trying to shed the crime thriller plot, and it's right. Like you are drawn to Cuba, to
right.
Isabella, to like, that is like pulling you away the whole time. And then you're like, oh shit, I have to go back to like do the fucking loads.
Right. Right. And it's the way that the characters, while they have pitch perfect technique, they seem bored by what they have to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's the performance of it, right? And you can sort of feel that, you know, like when they're talking to Jose Hierro, you know, and the Jackson Pollock on the wall and the rest of it. Another filmmaker, and you guys have talked often about how if you just read this script, you'd be like, well, okay.
Yeah.
You know,
might be good. I'm scared, Brian, of how many filmmakers that I would see make an absolute meal of this. They would there'd be nothing in the margins. It would just be straight down the line, and it would.
Yeah, it would be the surface execution of all the stuff, right? It would be a celebration of the moments that seem swaggy.
Yes.
You know, would be all the thing. And instead, when I'm watching the film, it's like, Tubbs has said this before. You know, you kind of feel it.
Yes.
Like, this is the routine. This is the act that you're doing, you know? And it gives you that feeling that this work has little reward a lot of the time. And I think that's maybe why lay people watch the movie and have an adverse reaction to it, because it's not a celebration of what it is. It's not a catalog. You know, you don't watch Miami Vice and say, I want to be an undercover cop.
It's not copaganda.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all, you know.
But you are like, do I want to hit on a really attractive waitress and get a mojito?
Yeah.
Right. In those little moments, you're like,
it's dirtbag propaganda.
It is what I think it's a film that does propagandize pursuing elevated experiences, like Mann always says, you know, and it does celebrate sort of doing the extra, crossing the boundary, doing the thing, and knowing it's not going to work out, you know, this is a bad idea and it has no future, right? But you're still kind of there. And you know,
and you bring it closer to you, because like, this is a bad idea, it has no future. And then he gets Isabella, and he brings her between his legs. It brings her closer, like, so let's go. Like, it's a bad idea, it has no future.
Yeah,
and like, pause. That doesn't mean we're not going to do it. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard. So swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's I think for at the time I saw it, when I was still kind of forming an idea of what I wanted to be and how much it was going to take to get me there, you know, I just sort of tapped into it emotionally. And I'll tell you, like, even now that my career is relatively stable, you know, and I'm very, you know, grateful to do as well as I do, I often feel like an undercover cop. You know, I often feel like I got to go to this studio and just get fed jurisdiction to do what I need to do. But I'm going to have to do a lot more than they're going to allow me to do in order to accomplish the goal. And I'm going to get no reward for doing all of that, but I get punished if I didn't get the job done. Right.
Yes.
And, you know, you're kind of in this mindset and you have these fleeting experiences with people creatively, you know, like, you know, when you're working on a television series, for instance, it's like being in summer camp. You're all like there sequestered. You're getting to know each other. You know, sometimes there's interpersonal relations that happen, but it's all like, it's all super brief and fleeting. You know, like when the sun comes up, you know, somebody's going to be on a boat, somebody's going to be on an island, right?
Right, right.
And you're like, no. Right. And you and you know that's how it ends when you start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's the pact you make with the end credits of your life modes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And old TV execs are like, I don't pay for a service. I pay for a result.
They
like,
pay for a result. They pay for the result.
100%.
You know, 100%. like all those moments, like, you know, Van Zandt is just an executive. That's all he is. Like, that's a studio executive. It's like, yeah, I know, I screwed you over on this thing, but it'll be fine and whatever, you know. And then they hang up the phone and tell, you know, Henry Rollins, that, you know, go kill that writer, you know.
Oh my God, you could lay on all of Michael Mann's experiences in Hollywood, like with all of these executives and assassins.
Okay, I think it's
and professionals.
It's
and
direct
artists.
An allegory.
I
know they're listening. One Heat Minute crew that's on our Patreon and Discord. You know what to do. That's all I'm saying. You know what to do. Find me who these people are. It'll be on the show.
Because the archetypes are all there, you know?
Yeah.
Like you have done some successful work, you've gotten yourself out of the muck of Hollywood, you're living by the beach, you just want to raise your family, and then your agent shows up with a project. Yeah. And your agent brought the pictures.
I love
you know?
It.
You're like, don't bring the pictures, Jack. You know? but you wrote the last three. The last three you wrote. You know, and you're just and so that's how I always read all of it, right?
Yeah,
and
it's brilliant.
it's that's why, like, you know, I kind of tapped into the film and you know, like the things that are given attention, you know, like I know what it's like to be talking to people that have immense money, immense resources, and your eyes can't help but drift to the Rolexes on their wrists or the Cartier watches on their wrists, yeah. Right? And like that moment, you know, it's a moment of these people are on that other level. Like,
yeah.
They have matching Cartier watches, and it's almost like it's like a moment in a book. It would be italicized. You get a paragraph, and for me, the paragraph is, I'm into her, but he gave them both Cartier watches.
Yeah,
there's a billion reasons why this is never going to work. Why she's never going to look at me that way. You know, like I'm getting
this guy just shut down the cell service.
He shut down the cell service.
This is the stuff they're going to do in Baghdad.
Right.
His Tubbs lining. You're like, oh, this is already a bad idea, even meeting this guy. And, oh, I just happen to be totally into the girl he's got a matching Cartier watch with. It's just like, it's layer upon layer of bad ideas.
Layer upon like, layer. You know, it's yeah.
Like, well, but the impulse is like, there's something that's the momentum of life, the momentum of this experience is just... Go, must go. Doesn't matter. Ignore all of these huge factoids. And it's just, he's not blind to them. That's what's even more brilliant about Miami mm-hmm. Vice. He's not blind to the consequences. He's completely laser focused in. And Michael Mann takes great attention to detail to go, no, he knows. He knows it's a bad idea.
The beautiful thing to me about watching a film from a filmmaker that you know is detail obsessed is it gives you permission to read it.
Yes. Yeah.
Right, because if you're watching a film with a filmmaker, right, that they're not detail obsessed, you're like, I don't know if that meant anything. I don't know. I don't even want to let my mind dance around it, right? But when you're looking at something and you're like, well, this guy's detail obsessed, so this all has like real meaning. Mm-hmm. On a previous podcast, you guys were talking to a filmmaker, and I really like the podcast a lot. Forgot the guy's name, but he was talking about how Mann's films tend not to show graphic violence. You know, they tend to kind of dance around it. You see the consequence of the violence itself. And he didn't bring up the arm getting shot off by the sniper in Miami Vice, which is one of the goriest things you're going to see in a Michael Mann film. But it's also one of the most important things because it shows you what that stuff does in the real world.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I said in the previous podcast, like heat is a brilliant example of why, you know, automatic weapons in normal metropolitan environments is no bueno.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And, for sure. It's not like video game. It's like this shit is loud.
It's loud.
This shit is violent. This shit is scary. Like
there's something wrong about it, right?
It's a recurring question that got asked during the Heat show. Was like, there are subsections of the audience of Heat that look at this and think it's cool as shit. And look, it's absolutely cool as shit as far as in the context of the movie. But I'm like, there's not a more terrifying gunfight. I can't watch it at night in my house. The way that it's mixed, mm-hmm. if you have a Blu-ray and it has a half decent sound system, when that gets there, I reckon it goes up maybe 4 to 5 decibels and the mix just goes, it will blow your TV speakers away. Like if it's midnight and you're like, I've done that thing where I got trapped watching Heat again, I will wake up my kids and my neighbors as soon as that gunfight comes on, because it's an overwhelming sensory experience to go. Guns are loud and fucking scary, and all those cops can't do anything. They're there with their six shooters falling all over each other, trying not to die because these automatic weapons are chewing holes in this. It's scary. It's actually violence that has a tangible physical reality.
Well, that's how I feel about the violence in Scorsese movies.
Yes.
Mm.
That it's real and it's gross and it's like in Goodfellas when he like stabs a guy in the trunk, like
right,
you're like, this is what it would be like to stab a guy in a trunk. It's not cool. These are bad guys.
Well, Scorsese, like a lot of filmmakers of that era, may not claim it, but they have a very close connection to horror.
Yeah, right? Yeah, absolutely.
And horror shows up. Coppola has it. I mean, Dementia 13 still shows up in his work. Like you can see it. Like it's that little undercurrent of understanding horror. And how to use it, you know, and Vice, you know, another kind of large impression of anti-genre for me is in most films that would be classified as action thrillers, and I think this would largely get classified as an action thriller in the brutalist version of genre creation, you're escalating towards climax, right? Like, you know, in the more like kind of hyperbolic version of it, like John Wick is all about getting to the part where he shoots everybody, right? Like, that's kind of why you're there. In Vice, the climax feels like a failure. Like, things went wrong, and so this is happening.
Yeah.
And there's little feeling of heroism in it. It just feels like this is an unfortunate consequence of terrible choices that were made, you know? And we're not going to celebrate this. Euro gets shot. We don't feel better. You don't feel better about that. He just turns people off. Like, he's turned off now. And for what, right?
Yeah.
And now we're back with these fucking bottom feeders. Now we're fighting off the Aryan Brotherhood. We know that Euro is the middleman. He's not this big. We're not conquering Archangel Jesus Montoya. We're not getting that guy. We're dealing with these guys who are his underlings, and they're going to kill us. And all we can do is try and mitigate it. Have some snipers and the freaking legendary. Actually, Barish Abaka Hanley has a bit of agent vibes. Your best agent of like, no. If you go into that meeting, we need two snipers on the as well. Yeah. And you know, we need two snipers, and I run it. Don't talk yet. I'll do the talking, you know, like, he kind of gets it. But it's that thing of like, all it is like death mitigation, that entire sequence.
It is funny because like, it doesn't, like, the emotional climax is the boat scene.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
the hospital bed. And the hospital bed.
Yeah. But like, I always kind of forget, like, I'm always like, I think the movie's like kind of going to end, and then it doesn't, and like keeps going. Like, it's like, you think that the big shootout is going to be, it keeps leading you up to it and then denying it.
Right.
Like, denying the genre, like you're saying, like, it is anti-genre.
It's like, what's supposed to happen? Like, nobody wanted that to happen. Right. Like it's a victory for Jose Euro that it's even taking place.
Yes.
Because he's the creature of the basest things, and he has managed to drag all of these people into the basest parts of his character, you know, and he's the only one that genuinely joyous to be there, because you can feel it in John's performance, that it's like, you know, this, what's wonderful about this is now everyone's as shitty as I am.
Yeah.
You know, oh, you're going to be as shitty as me. She might now. You know, like, I'm, you know, like, what, like, I dragged everybody down into my shit with this. And
Cochin Loco.
Right? Is it big? You don't want to know about. John's a friend of mine on Twitter, so shout out to John.
My God.
Hook it up. We need John on our podcast.
Bring John's like super, he's super chill and open. Like, you could easily get John. I'll reach out. But
John Ortiz, honestly, John Ortiz, in this movie, so forgetting about this movie for a second, he's fucking excellent in absolutely everything that he does. He's like just one of those chameleonic, legendary character actors. In this movie, it's such a joy, because I know that he in real life, rest in peace, was friends with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And this is such a Philip Seymour, like, they feel like they're from the same wheelhouse, because this feels like one of those early Philip Seymour Hoffman performances where he's not just relegated to being an amazing character actor, where you're like, this motherfucker is it. Like, he's now a foil. He's like bringing him through. And it's like, I love looking at this performance, because I'm like, after this, how does this guy not have a Philip Seymour Hoffman-esque arc, like, where you start trusting him to carry a whole movie? Because he's the counterweight to the whole freaking movie, and he absolutely rules.
Oh, he's a brilliant actor. You know, when anyone tells me that Miami Vice isn't a good film, I'm like, well, you're objectively wrong, because it has both John Ortiz and John Hawks, so we can't.
Like, that's there a rule. You go.
Like, if you
there
got John Ortiz and John Hawks in your movie's good.
Yeah.
Like,
yes, you know. I like this as a rule.
it's absolutely solid, and everybody else wrong. You know, I mean, it's totally that way. Yeah, you know, Hoffman was great. Hoffman was terrifying in Mission Impossible. I didn't realize, like, I was watching Mission Impossible, and I'm like, I don't think Tom Cruise gonna win. I don't care how fast Tom Cruise can run. I don't think he's gonna win this time. Like, I was genuinely worried. I was like, I don't know, Ethan. You might need somebody else. Call Pierce Brosnan and get him over there or something. Like, you might need something. I don't know.
One thing you said before, which I did want to touch on, was about there's a line
that actually Jerry Seinfeld said on his show, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, and he's talking to his old friend, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and he gave her marriage advice. But I think this is also just loving things advice in the world. He goes, I'll give you marriage advice 101. Your wife says you're wrong, and your response is, I'm fine. And I think about that with Miami Vice a lot of the time. People, I'm like, Miami Vice, a masterpiece. And they go, you're wrong. And I go, I'm fine. Like, that is as much as I'm willing to engage. Because if you're that off, I'm not, okay.
Yeah.
We can just move on. You're wrong. I'm fine. Marriage 101.
And on a filmmaking level, it gets more interesting to me the more I view it, because technology is what it is, right?
Yes.
So like, you know, when I talk to like young filmmaker friends of mine who, you know, are kind of navel gazing because they don't have the latest 8K, whatever, whatever. I'm like, bro, Miami Vice was shot on like an iPhone 3.
Yeah.
Like, just get out here and make it.
Yeah.
Right. You know? And like, embrace the format and the texture of it. Yeah. And like, make your technology like match your story that you want to tell. Yeah. I mean, look at like a great movie that came out last year. I mean, he is a Nepo baby, but funny, what was, oh God, Owen Klein's movie, funny people, no.
I know the one.
Funny pages,
yeah.
I mean, he shot it on like 8mm film or 16mm, but it's perfectly fits the story of what he's trying to tell, and like the texture and the grime and the weirdness of the place. And like, it's just like, if you are working with an iPhone, like, do a Sean Baker, shoot Tangerine, like, make it work for the story that you want to tell and the like, the energy, the atmosphere that you want to evoke.
Absolutely. Like, it, you know, it's a stark reminder that, okay, so there's a 30-second aside. So the relationship between film and technology, I don't think it's analyzed enough, right? It's something that we need to audit, I think, on a regular basis. Because our understanding of what a film is completely dependent on the technology of the time.
Yeah.
You know, from silent films to talkies, black and white to color and the rest of it, right? And so the art form is tied to technology in an interesting way. That like books really aren't, and paintings aren't, and all that. And so, you know, you're looking at this thing and you're like, oh, well, wait a minute. I can get a better image right now on my iPhone in terms of just like fidelity. So there's really nothing stopping me from being able to capture this kind of power. I mean, there's storytelling, there's writing, there's you know, there's production design, art direction, all the other stuff, but like, you can do it, you know? And so, and that's why I think it's such an invigorating film, because I always, you know, I've seen it countless times, right? And every time I watch it, and sometimes I'll just put it on just for the vibe, I leave that viewing feeling more empowered creatively. You know,
it's like, amazing.
I can do this. I can task this. You know, I can put a messy scene down and come back and kind of rejigger it. You know, and it doesn't have to always kind of like fit into a neat little box. And I can, you know, and we can have these different sojourns. And that's why I think it's just such a, like, a remarkable gift to film writ large, but especially films that are about, you know, kind of action and all of that, and action thriller and Heat, I think, is a superior film in terms of its construction and all of that, and sure, but I think it's almost like you're getting like Da Vinci's workbook with Miami.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
but it's, but like, it's, ooh. you're talking exactly about the mediums. It's like, in the 35, you have to be more orchestrated, and you have to be less impulsive and verite. You know, you were talking about the Italian neorealism. It's like, you can't be in as many open locations. And when you are, there are other factors that you have to deal with to figure it out. But like, you know, when you were saying about the make the film and use the technology, this is a theme that Katie's really brought up on the show. And I just love it when we get to talk about it, because it's like, Miami Vice is unashamedly a digital film. It is like, it is not trying to use digital technology to enable them to make a cheaper version of an actual film. It's going, no, I'm making a digital film.
Yeah.
And that means that I can see a depth of field and different colors and weird like tones and notes and hues of the city that you can't capture on film unless you muck around with it or you play around with lights or whatever. You cannot catch it on 35. You can't. 16 mil, forget it. It's not happening. Maybe on a 70, maybe planted lights, tweaked, color corrected, maybe. But I can go onto a rooftop and it looks like this undulating
bursting storm cloud of purple with this yellow, strange haze that is coming off of all of the city streetlights. And there's all this beautiful, almost like organic, like spectrum of colors that go between. And then I've got this like awesome, like looking guy with a blonde mullet and a freaking gray suit on a roof. It's like the technology is, that's the thing I love about Michael Mann. He's like, he's unabashedly making a digital film.
Yeah.
And he's not trying to cheat people. It's not, it's like, this is what it is. And that's the same with like a Tangerine. And like the benefit that you get is that I can put a small digital camera on the back of a utility vehicle and smash through doors. And I can be with the camera in that moment, and it's great and it's fantastic and it's, you know, visceral. But you know, that's what I love about Miami Vice. Like, no, it actually is beautiful. And when people are like, oh, it's ugly, I always,
oh my God, those people have to have their eyes replaced.
I'm just like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Well, it's you know, kind of engaging what you're saying, Blake. One of the things I love about filmmakers when I love their work is when they can get me to see what I see every day differently.
Yeah.
And there's a, you know, it looked like a Karen Kusama film. There's a hypnagogic quality to it, right? Like, yes. Those films take place on Kusama Earth.
Destroyer the Invitation. Like, right. My God. Completely different visual impressions of the same
like
city.
They're taking you into their dimension, like Scorsese Earth.
Yes.
It's just a different Earth, you know, and living in LA has only deeply increased my love of Mann's work, because I'm like, oh, I never looked at Koreatown like that, you know,
or
I never looked at coastlines like that. And it's that hypnagogic feel, you know, and Vice feels like you watched a straightforward version of this when you were drunk.
Yes.
And this is the way you remember it.
Yeah.
You know, like I remember, and then she came out of the limousine and said, like,
yes.
Well, whatever he says, do not do it. And you were like, yeah, that was it. I think that happened. And you're just, and it's great, you know, it kind of hits you on that, like in a hypnagogic level, right? It's film is music, which really appeals to me. And that's a rare thing. And you know, you look at like 06, like that's when things started to get super standardized. You know, like we sort of lost, I don't want to say it's a vanity project with a negative connotation, but I mean, that's when, you know, studios were starting to belt tighten a little bit. And, you know, the filmmaker that would get too much money to do a thing in a weird way, that started to slow down more and more. And now we rarely get that. You know, we rarely see that. And to be able to watch a filmmaker who, you know, created this world with peers on television, worked through it, was obviously constrained by the 4-3, was obviously constrained by commercial breaks and budget and time and the rest of it, and to see like what they do when they go back, you know, to that with everything that they need to kind of do what they want to do. It's incredibly fascinating and empowering, I think, in an artistic way. And you know, just, you know, like again, like going, you can see the Godard in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, you can see the Truffaut in it, right? Like all that AFI stuff that he did still shows up when he's doing like, you know, TNT films for men. You know, like whatever, you know, like whatever that nonsense is they do, right?
You're
like,
yeah,
but it's also, you know,
it's also
things.
French impressionism and like, you know, what's that word? Oh, God, it's like a film school word. It's not coming to me. Anyway, keep going. I'll figure it out.
Most of my film school words don't come to me. So that is a malady that I also share. But yeah, I think that what's really beautiful about it is it is a film that is about the pursuit of those like kind of that inner desire to have those experiences for the sake of them, even though you know it may not quote unquote turn out, you know, it says to you, chase it, don't chase it for forever, chase it for now, you know,
because it might not be right for forever, but who cares about forever, we're in now.
You're in and the now.
The whole movie is saying, we're here right now. Like, it's like, we're yeah, in right. the club.
And you may not be able, you may not be able to love someone more than when you know you cannot love them forever.
Yes.
You know, when you know there is sand in the hourglass on this, you have this beach walk, you have this dance in the club, you know, you have this night. And it speaks to those moments when the inherent sort of temporary, you know, nature of what it is removes all pretense. And so you're crying while you're making love. Right? Because yeah. you're that tapped into it. You know, it's
I'd be
it's
crying so if I was making love to Gong Li too. I mean, let's
tell me about it.
Tell me about it.
I'd be crying if I was making love to 2006 Colin Farrell. So handlebar mustache. Okay, so the word that I was thinking of is photogenie. Do you know photogenie?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From early silent French, for Jean sure. Epstein. It's like the je ne sais quoi. It's like the expressiveness of cinema, the mm-hmm. poetry of images and sound and cinema and time coming together. And like, this is an action movie from friggin' 2006 that has photogenie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's what I think is so beautiful about it. And that's, and I love that you guys are talking about like how it's an exercise in being present as well, because it's, you know, it's all about time and being in the moment and sort of forcing you to stay in this moment, whatever is happening, when the camera sort of drifts or it's like we're in an emotional scene. I just love how you talk about this movie. And I also really relate to you very deeply on this dichotomy of loving genre, loving action films and horror and whatever, and then also being like, yeah, I'll fuck with like some crazy French art house movies or like European, like bleak ass Russian movies. I totally sure. get down with those. And like, just being like, I contain multitudes and like things can, you know, there can be two things that are true at once or many things that are true at once and many things that you can contain in one person. But also it's like, this film is such a special example of containing multitudes, right? Well, of containing absolutely. All of those things at once.
Absolutely, Katie. Like, I am a big proponent of having a syncretic artistic mind. You know, I like working with things that are seemingly in opposition and finding where the common denominators are. I think that's where innovation comes in. That's where your voice comes in.
You tinker with, well, I didn't know so much about the music, but knowing you for a little bit, filmmaking, writing, but you're also a really fucking good photographer, Brian. Like,
well, thank you.
You know, like, he takes great photos, and now learning that you tinker with music as well, it's just like, it just feels like these little tendrils, these little parts of yourself that you're like, how do I know some of this stuff and bring it into how I'm going to do it? And just thinking about storytelling in all of these different media, whether it's like you're telling a story in just a still, a great black and white still, you know, that's something.
Not to get like too like, you know, weird and granola about it, but you know,
we want to get weird and granola.
Because anyone who is listening to this is either a creator or deeply interested in creators. And so, you know, what I would say is understand your nature as an artist while you're working on your individual tasks, and understand what drives you. From an emotional level, from a thematic level, right? Whether you're writing a story, you're making a film, you're cooking a meal, you're making love, like whatever it is, like find that inner truth that's there. Like, what is it that moves you? Because you can apply that to multiple forms. You know, I mean, that's where you become like the polymath, right? Which I think is kind of a misnomer. I think, you know, it's just, you know, a polymath is described as someone who's very good at these individual things. I don't think that's true. I think a polymath is someone who's very good at knowing who they are, and they manifest who they are in different tasks.
Yeah.
You know, and so all of it is, the music is Brian Hill, the cooking is Brian Hill, the thing, you know what I mean? It's just me, right? It's your authenticity. And again, it goes back to like the central man theme of like nearly all of his works. Like, how do you maintain your authenticity in a world that seeks to destroy it?
Right? Yes.
And that's really the question, you know? And if you look at Vice, Another thing about it is I think it's the beginning of what I call man's romantic period.
Yeah.
Where he genuinely embraces romance. And, you know, it small thematics here and there previously, but if you look at like Heat, right? Like,
and form and subject, right? On yours, like you were talking before, you know, Heat has the romance, obviously, but
yeah,
it's like Last of the Mohicans. It's like the form, the period, the time, everything about that bespeaks romance. So people can, I feel like people are easier for them to translate the romance through that. But when you're talking about like his later digital forms and stuff like that, he's like, no, right, this is like our romance. This is our romance.
I think Mohicans is sort of like, because it's kind of a cover song, right?
Yes.
It's sort of like, well, I'm going to play Zeppelin, and then I'm kind of understanding how I would go about it, right? So because it was laid in already into the Fenimore Cooper in its own way, you know, it's sort of like I can kind of approach it and do that thing. Same thing in The Keep in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah.
But I look at like, you know, I look at Heat where, you know, Heat kind of grieves the idea of romance, you know, and like Edie and Neil is doomed, and so are Isabella and Sonny, but the difference is Edie and Neil is doomed in a way where you like don't enjoy the doom of it.
No.
You know, you're just like, this is, not only is this a bad
she doesn't
idea,
have
no
she
future.
Doesn't have any, she doesn't have any idea what the fuck
right.
is going
it's
on.
It's different.
But
it's...
Sonny and Isabella, she knows
they're
it's
equals.
A bad idea. He knows
they
it's a bad
equals.
Idea. Yeah.
And really Isabella is like, you know, one of the few times, maybe even the first time, that you have a female character in a man's story. I guess Mohicans, but again, that's Fenimore Cooper's running on top of it. In an original man's story that doesn't act as a barrier to the man's growth, right? Like if I have a criticism of kind of man's oeuvre, it's that I think oftentimes the female characters stand in the way of what the man needs to accomplish, right? There's still that little bit of classic Western in there.
Yes.
There's still that little bit of John Ford, you know, where in order for me to become what I need to be, I need to leave you at the house and I need to go and fight the engines, you know?
A good balance is Kim Grace's Molly Graham when she's talking to Dennis Farina's Jack Crawford. She's like, don't you fuck him up, Jack. Like, she's like, he's actually fixed now. You know,
right.
Don't fuck him up, Jack. And I love, and she's so underrated in that regard because I'm like, don't you fuck him up, Jack.
And I don't, you know, and I don't think it's anywhere near misogyny or chauvinism or anything like that. I just think it's sort of like the way the stories kind of get told, and you know, and then Kim Grease's character, we're working on top of Thomas Harris, right? So you have to also include that, right?
Yeah.
So Molly is, you know, kind of there, but you know, Isabella really is her own person.
Yeah.
In this film. And if you look at like the later films, you see more of an embrace of kind of romance, you know, like there's a sweetness in Collateral that wasn't really there in his work before in that way.
Jada Max, you know, that Jada Max relationship, Jada and Jamie Foxx, that is just electric.
Yeah,
like 10 minutes and you feel like, like it's just so joyful and you're like, oh, this is like chemistry happening right before our eyes.
By the way, Stuart Beatty is a good friend of mine.
We did speak to him about Collateral and he did confirm that Vincent's name
is
Vincent Collateral, as some stupid people on the internet have said. He was funny enough to claim that. But no, he actually said, no, that's not his name. He said, but Vincent... You don't even know Vincent's surname. It's something different than that. So he knows what
his
that is.
His name's not even Vincent.
His name's not even Vincent. It's the best
Stuart,
one.
Stuart's a great guy. He's a good friend of mine.
But I was going to say also, I mean, like Trudy and Tubbs are equals as
Absolutely.
Well. And like, I really like them as a counterbalance to the Sonny Isabella whirlwind romance, like doomed, but going to do it. And like, they're... you know, equals in this and they know what's going on and they're, you know, but then Trudy and Tubbs, that's like the sweet domestic, like they're not doomed. They're going to move forward. They're working together. He's trying to save her. He's trying to keep her safe. And like that little, you know, that I think is such a sweet romantic love story because it's like the normal, not crazy love story. It's like the domestic life, which I feel like that's probably what man has because he's been married for so long.
Right. And absolutely, Katie. And I think that's one of the things that is the most undervalued, I think, about Miami Vice, right? I
mean, yeah.
There's a lot of words thrown at, well, you know, Fox had these Oscar things, and then, like, why is Crockett, you know, in front of him, and the poster, and the tension between Colin Farrell and the rest of it, and that's all fine. But, you know, when I look at the film, you'd be hard-pressed to find another, like, kind of, you know, mainline Hollywood depiction of a Black relationship that feels as warm and genuine and as authentic as that.
Yeah, and it's, you know? Like, authentic and funny and...
Yeah.
Really like filled with a lot of like stakes and heart, and like they really care for each other and they're equals, they're coworkers. Like there's just, I love that relationship.
It's excellently done. And then when you get into the marrow of how some of the scenes are executed, you know, it's denying like the kind of the gravitational force of the scene to go where these scenes normally go. So a scene where Tubbs is reassuring Trudy turns into a scene where Trudy is reminding Tubbs of what he has to do.
Yeah. Right? She's like, And she's also, I just love the hint of doom. I think because Trudy's just such a sage, and I love her because she's like, you are doomed if you keep thinking about me.
Yeah, yeah.
You're right. Going to be, if you keep distracting and trying to keep me in this box and not make me your equal and a partner in this, I am going to be doomed. And it's that self-fulfilling prophecy of like, where are your eyes? And is he right? Yes. But is she right? Yes. And it's this great thing of like, this is, you know, it's the Hyman Roth. This is the business we've chosen, you know, like it's like totally that. It's like, this is the business. Okay. And Katie and I, Brian, made a Miami Nice cut of Miami Vice, which is a fusion of the director's and theatrical cuts. It is sitting in your inbox, in your DMs right now for you to watch.
Wonderful.
So it's there for you to enjoy. But that was part of the thing when we made our cut was restoring especially the salutations from your friends in the South and the follow-up diner moment between Trudy and Tubbs, because that relationship feels so much more fulfilled and rewarding in that director's cut, because you get these extra scenes that maybe like that were just for momentum's sake, they're trying to get rid of them, but I don't think it loses anything. In fact, I think it gains everything for all the other scenes and the way that it informs
it. All of the like I think it, in a sense, it adds emotional momentum to the pizza scene, the in the trailer park, and like all of that. Like it's like you are way more locked in with the Tubbs of it all, you know, as we move into the climax, you know, of craziness, violence and stuff. Yeah.
It's, you know, in my most pretentious time, I was working on like a small, like kind of essay book, and it was called Man and Women. And it was about women in Michael Mann films, you know, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I wrote like 100 pages of this thing, and then I just stopped because I was like, who wants to deal with this?
There's a website called oneheatminute.com that would love some of those essays.
I have to research it up. But one of the things I was highlighting is, like, again, I don't know a lot about Mann's personal life, but I feel like he is a guy that has had really powerful and effective affecting relationships with women, you know, in various ways, right? And I think part of why I identify with this work is I was raised by a single mother. My father died when I was a kid. So my mother kind of had to step into the role of both mother and father as I was growing up, and it sort of framed a lot of me in my formative years. And there's something that man understands about in a difficult time what men like to hear from the women in their lives, you know? And when Tubbs is talking to Trudy, like that's what he needs to hear.
Yeah.
He doesn't need to hear, I feel like I'm okay. I know you'll protect me. That's not what he needs to hear.
No.
He needs to hear, I am giving you permission and instruction to do what you need to do, and I am okay, but you need to do that. And it's a small thing, but as a person that lives a high risk life in a lot of ways, and being like a screenwriter, filmmaker, working in Hollywood, you're living a high risk life. I mean, you literally are gonna have meetings that are $500,000 you know, $750,000, right? If the meeting goes well, if you say the right things in the right order, you're talking about 15 minutes of your time might result in a small fortune if you're lucky.
You know? Right. And also that, like, it's feast or famine. Like,
and it's feast or famine.
You might not work for a long time.
Right. You know, it's hot and cold, and you got to balance your thing out. And so you're living, you know, you're kind of living in this high risk mode. And in our interpersonal relationships, there are just things that are really empowering to kind of hear from the people that we love. And he understands how to craft those moments in a way that makes immediate sense. You know, and I think that's why a lot of dudes, you know, they won't talk about it, but they love the romance in the movie as much as anyone else does, because, you know, we want our Isabella on the beach, you know, like we want that, right? Like we would throw it all away for a boat ride with Gong Li.
But you also want your Trudy, squeezing your hand in the hospital bed. Like that's the stability. And like, you also want her, like your queen being like, yes, go do your thing. But like, it's like, I feel like it combines all of these fantasies of romance.
Yeah, and it's that's like, you know what, because of the fable quality of it, you know, and I think fables, you know, whether they're contemporary or they're ancient, kind of exist to help illustrate the lives we're living and the choices we're making and the potential effect of those choices, you know. When something does live in that fable like space, snapshot 2006, snapshot crime thriller, snapshot cocaine cowboy, whatever it is, you know, you're kind of able to read it in that way. And it's a fairy tale, you know, in a lot of ways. It's a grim fairy tale, like the classic fairy tales used to be. And as much as man gets credit for being, you know, a creature of verisimilitude and detail and research and the rest of it, you know, that exists, certainly. But in execution, that kind of translates into these hypnagogic fairy tale narrative experiences that help illuminate our past, our present, and how choices of the present could affect our future. And that's why I find so incredibly kind of powerful about that work. It's clarifying too.
I could listen to you talk about this movie for hours. Like, it's just,
well, we live in LA, so, and good. There's plenty of places serve food.
Yes. Oh my God. Let's do I need to host a Miami Nice meetup in LA.
We should absolutely do a meetup and like get a bunch of heads together and just be
get Travis
Numb Encore on a loop.
You're walking into a hallway and it's just Numb Encore, and it's just those silhouettes of people dancing as you walk into the meetup. That's what you've got to do.
We're planning this.
Listen, what I would say is, number one, we have to have you back at some point, Brian. This has been so much fun. This is absolutely sensational. I knew that this would be fire, but you really shot through the stratosphere for me in this chat, because you're so insightful about it. Your mind, I love the way that your mind works. It's just totally a treat to talk to you about this movie, because you know, you're a ride or die from the beginning, and you got it. And I just love that you are so uncompromising with you. Like, oh, everyone's wrong. And I love that so much.
I'm fine.
And so we are all collectively fine, man. It's just a brilliant time talking to you. Is there anything that you want to plug or point people to? We'll obviously link off to your website and your Twitter and stuff like that. But is there anything just as the last minute that you want to plug while we've got you?
Briefly, the second half of the final season of Titans, a show that I write on, Woo! Will be premiering at HBO Max in, I don't know when this is going to come out. So, March 2023 at some time. I got some cool screenwriting announcements I can't really talk about, like a directorial announcement I can't really talk about. And I'm doing some cool comic book things I can't really talk about. So everyone listening,
if you find me interesting, follow
me at Brian Edward Hill. Why is how I spell it, B-R-Y-A, and at Brian Edward Hill. Why? Because we like you. And you can follow me there. And you know, I tend to do Twitter and spurts and all that, but if you catch me on a wave, you know, I'll be be running it down.
Follow the next wave because he's about to watch the Miami Nice Cup. Brian, you rule. We're definitely having you back. We'll find another. I mean, we could probably talk for 5 hours, but we'll find another good hour on Miami Vice, and then we'll maybe come back for a little collateral confession. We'll maybe talk to you a little bit about some collateral.
Absolutely. I have thoughts, Blake.
The collateral meetup is just one of those really long stretch hummers through LA.
The collateral meetup is on me, and it's going to be Korean barbecue at a long table, like five fire pits going.
Yeah.
And endless beer and soju.
Yes.
So just let me know when you want that to happen, and that will happen.
Stuart Beatty in there actually telling us Vincent's real name. You rock. Yeah. You're the best. This has been sensational. And I know people are going to enjoy it, so we have to have you back. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Choose Vice, choose Linen, choose Mojitos, choose Hot Colin and Pissed Off Jamie Foxx, choose an improvised Jackson Pollock on the wall and choose to be a fucking disco guy if you want, choose sophisticated counter intel and AWACS and ships impersonating buildings, choose the bad shit with the crazy whites at the trailer park, choose to shine me off even if you don't have the skill, choose a go fast boat and the buyer changes the location at the last minute, choose to let her go with a guy named Frank. I chose none of that. I chose to live. I chose something else. I chose which way is up, and I didn't give a fuck which way it was. I chose Gong Fucking Lee, and I know that it's a bad idea and it has no future. Because I chose luck. Because time is luck. And what else would you choose?
You know, and it feels like such a 20th century movie. It feels like something David Lean would have done or tried to do when he still had that kind of currency. And even then, he might not have succeeded.
It's incredible because, like, if you don't have time to watch all 5 seasons of Lost, you can just watch Fearless.
Not a week goes by that I don't think of the ending of Gallipoli. It's left a mark. A Year of Living Dangerously. You know, and then something like Last Wave, even, that's so deeply embedded with the land and the story of the land, the story of place. You know, I don't know that I'd seen very many movies at that point in my life that had such a down ending, and they had such a, you know, sort of strong sense of folklore attached to it as that. And something always so poetic and lyrical about Peter Weir's work.
Gallipoli was the first movie that ever traumatized me, and I don't think I ever really recovered from it. And I'm still upset that they played it in school. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to make they say it's not possible to make an anti-war movie, but I think Peter Weir pulled it off.
Yes.
Because no one watches that movie then thinks, I want to go to war.
Peter Weir is the greatest director that Australia has ever produced. Like, bar none, hands down. Like, no one else is even in the room.
I think you have covered some really titanic filmmakers and some really titanic films so far, but I truly think what makes Peter Weir special and what makes you doing this one special is we don't talk about Peter Weir that way, and we should. Peter Weir is one of those guys who I don't get why he isn't a bigger name, why he isn't more in that rarefied air.
Yes.
Because I think film for film, he's one of our very best filmmakers. He has brought his A game repeatedly to many properties. There are films of his that I hold very dear. Fearless, The Mosquito Coast. I will fight somebody if they talk bad about The Mosquito Coast. It's, man, I love that movie. But in general, I just think he is a special filmmaker, a smart, lyrical, hallucinatory filmmaker. He's a very dreamy filmmaker, and I don't think he gets his due.
You know, Master and Commander is one of my all-time favorite movies. It's easily one of the best movies of the last 20 years. It's You know, it's a grand scale. There's a historical backdrop to it, but at the same time, there's such an intimacy in the relationships.
Which I think is not just a great film and one of the last great epics in the truest sense. I think is actually kind of a sliding doors change point moment in cinema history. I think 2003, when that comes along and it is an old fashioned, you know, we don't make them like that anymore type film. I think if Master and Commander spawns a franchise at that point, the entire cinema landscape globally is completely different.
That's the movie that I wanted to see 10 of those, you know. I know they're big fans of Fast and Furious and everything, and God bless you, but Master and Commander should have been.
It's one of those things, again, I am not I'm not a seafaring man, sir. But there is a sense of authenticity. There's a sense of really watching a genuine dedication to recreating history unfold on a big screen in front of you that can't help but inspire just genuine admiration and awe.
If you're going to pick a film where he really brings every one of his skills to the table, it's Master and Commander. I think you picked the right one, man.
Yeah, very excited to see what you pull out of this, Blake.
That's right. Our next series is Peter Weir and Russell Crowe's Master and Commander. The series is called Podcaster and Commander.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotions section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.